Anyways, it is 11 o'clock, so we want to welcome back Dr. Schwartz for part three of our series on modern and ancient roots of modern anti-Semitism. And let's look forward to another detective. I don't know if we're going to have a comma, an exclamation point. I don't know what it will be this week that triggered your research, but let's wait and hear. I'm sorry?
Can I share the screen?
Okay. Oh, yeah, you can share your screen. Your co-host and...
Here we go. All right. So you can hear me? Can you hear me? All right. So
yeah.
I'm going to be talking today about the impact of the Holocaust in a devious way on the modern study of ancient Jewish rebels. And as you see, I wrote an article a good number of years ago on Christian study of the Zealots, and that has a good part of it, has to do with a good part of it, but it's not the whole story. Before I get into the modern issue, I'll just tell you bird's eye view what we're talking about. When we're talking about Jewish rebels against Rome, we're talking about a whole bunch of periods and incidents over a long period of time, beginning with the first entry of Rome into Judea at 63 BCE. And this is what Shalit was talking about last week. Shalit was complaining that instead of welcoming the Romans, the Jews rebelled against them at the beginning, and that let things start off on the wrong foot. Didn't only start off that way, but it went on over the next 20 years during the entire period of Rome's vassal rule of Judea through a Hasmonean, Hyrcanus II, his brother Aristobulus II, and his brother's children were rebelling time and again. You can probably define them as seven different waves of rebellion, which the Romans had to put down each time, in which Jews were trying to put an end to Roman rule in order to establish the other Hasmonean instead of the Hasmonean who was cooperating with Rome. That's the type of thing Shalit was complaining about last week. When Herod took over, he was able to keep the peace for a long time. But after he died, rebellions broke out again in the year 4 BCE. And we hear about several different centers of rebellion. At the time, it doesn't really matter. Nothing all that much came of it, but it did require Roman intervention. Roman troops came from Syria. Some damage was actually done to the temple at that time in the fighting. 10 years later, after Herod's son was expelled from Judea and direct Roman rule was established, we hear then in a number of sources about a major rebellion by Judeans against the Romans. This is a very formal event when the Romans are setting up provincial rule and taking a census. You have Jews who are rebelling against Rome, and they had to bring in the troops again from Syria. Over the next 60 years of Roman rule in Judea via governors, there are lots of incidents. I'm not going to give details, but you've heard names like Pontius Pilate, who was the governor of the time of Jesus, and afterwards, Cumanus, Felix, Albinus, Florus, lots and lots of rebellion, especially towards 66. The last couple of decades before 66 are full of violence. Josephus tells the story that way, and it does fulfill a literary role in Josephus's narrative because it gives readers the impression things are going downhill, they're going to have to explode soon. But probably it was happening, and they did explode soon. So there's some balance there between understanding Josephus as an author, as an historian. But one way or the other, there was lots of violence in this period, and the rebellion did break out in 66 CE and went on for another 7 years or so, which sounds like a long time, as if it were very hard for the Romans to win that rebellion. And it did take some effort on their half, but it wasn't such a major war for them. There were simply long periods of time when nothing much was happening because the Romans had other things to do and they didn't pursue the putting down of the rebellion. It culminates in 70, in the summer of 70, Tisha B'Av, with the destruction of the temple and the rest of Jerusalem and the destruction, conquest of Masada. A few years later, there's debate until today as to whether that was in 73 or 74 CE, and it doesn't really matter. What is interesting for what's going to come is that the commander of Masada, according to Josephus, was somebody named Elazar ben Yair, who was the grandson of Judas the Galilean, who was the leader of the rebellion in 6 CE. So this gives something of an impression of continuity. Yes, it's not just an isolated incident, but if Judas the Galilean is rebelling in 6 CE and his grandson is running the fort at Masada, which is holding out long after the fall of Jerusalem, and as a matter of fact, Josephus reports some activity by the intermediate generation as well, by the parents of Elazar ben Yair. So this is something which fuels the imagination when you think about continuity of ancient Jewish rebelliousness. After the destruction of the temple, we next hear of rebellions in the diaspora. It's not really clear whether it's one rebellion with the various centers with some sort of central planning, or are these separate events which happen to happen at the same time. But one way or the other, we hear of a number of Jewish rebellions in the diaspora against Rome in the days of the Emperor Trajan. And then another half generation later, there's the Bar Kokhba rebellion in Jerusalem, in Judea, which is basically the last of the ancient Jewish rebellions against Rome. And all of these rebellions were failures, but some took more and some took less time before the Romans eventually put them down. And what we're going to be talking today is about modern study of these Jewish rebels. And the rabbi asked, well, what's it going to be this time? Is it going to be a comma like it was 2 weeks ago? Or is it going to be a footnote like it was last week? Last week, I told you it all began with Shalit referring to an article that didn't exist instead of referring to an article that did exist. This week, it's something else. There is here in Jerusalem a huge library run by French Dominican monks. It's called the École Biblique, the School of Biblical Studies. It's been around for generations. It has a huge library. And once upon a time, I noticed when I was looking for articles about zealots, which is a term which is commonly used for ancient Jewish rebels, I noticed that there are 28 articles in the published catalog of this library. The catalog was published in 1986. It reflects things they've been collecting for about a century. And nevertheless, all of the articles which were listed there appeared between 1958 and 1976. And I was wondering, why was there this flourishing of study of the zealots in that period of time, not before and not after? They had another 10 years of cataloging after that, and they had decades and decades before that. Why is there such a flourishing then and not before? And then you start looking around and say, oh, you know, it's not just the catalog of the École Biblique. But if you start looking on standard bookshelves and standard bibliographies of who's writing about ancient Jewish rebelliousness. So the guy who started off mostly in the modern period after World War II, Farmer wrote a book, Maccabees, Zealots, and Josephus in 1956. Martin Hengel, who I've already mentioned here, wrote his doctoral dissertation on Die Zeloten, namely the Zealots. And it appeared as a published volume in 1961. And there was a second English edition in German. And the second edition appeared in English in 1989. A big book, very learned dissertation. In 66, there appeared Yadin's book, Masada. Some of you are probably familiar with this book. It was very popular a couple of decades ago. It's a book about the Zealots' last stand. And it has to do with his excavations at Masada, where that last stand was. Averbach was one of my teachers in Baltimore decades ago, wrote a book in 1966 on the Roman-Jewish War. My main teacher in Jerusalem was the late Menachem Stern. And look at this, the Encyclopedia Judaica Yearbook, a book which, you know, comes out once a year. What's interesting to talk about in the Jewish world in 1973? Includes an article on the Zealots. David Rhodes writes a book on the same topic in 1976. There's a series of volumes called The World History of the Jewish People. which is divided according to historical periods and places. And it saw fit to include an entire volume in 1983 on the Judean revolts against Rome, which is not at all to be taken for granted that a topic like that would be worthy in their eyes of having an entire volume. So everything is very intense in this period, and I was wondering why. And there are a couple of obvious answers. One of them is, well, Zealots are a type of sects. They're a type of group, collective, in ancient Judaism. And the study of Jewish sects was very popular beginning in the late 40s and 1950s, apropos of the discoveries in Qumran. Dead Sea Scrolls started coming out of the ground in 1947. They were published especially in the course of the 50s and the 60s, and everybody was doing Jewish sectarianism. And when you start talking about ancient Jewish groups, well, groups which are other than Qumran are going to get attention as well. And there were even some attempts by Jews to make the Qumran sectarians into zealots. There were there was lots of Christian interest in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There still is today, but beginning in the 50s and 60s, lots and lots of interest in the Dead Sea Scrolls as representing a sect which was taken to be forerunners of Christianity. And some Jews who were not happy about that were trying to say, no, no, they're our guys, they're not your guys, and to turn them into rebels. Something else more general, but definitely there, was the existence of the State of Israel. The State of Israel put Jewish nationalism, militant Jewish nationalism, on the map. I talked something about that last week already. We talked about Shalit and Klausner, who were lauding rebels in the 1930s and 1940s. That's when their paths parted, and that's what I talked about last week. But here, for example, we have Klausner's book on Kesheuman Yochemet Al-Kheruta. It's a collection of essays, When a People Fights for Its Freedom, has essays on Judah Maccabee, on the Giborei Mitzada, the heroes of Masada, John of Gishkala, and Simon Bar Giora, who are two of the rebel leaders in the Great Rebellion against Rome beginning in 66, Bar Kokhba. This book went through 11 editions between 1936 and 1960. Now, believe me, books by historians don't go through 11 editions unless there's some very special interest. And this simply indicates just how enthusiastic Israelis were about reading about ancient Jewish militant nationalism, because it served as a model when thinking about the modern state of Israel and its wars and its success. And the Masada excavations were accompanied by a lot of fanfare. Everybody knew that Yigal Yadin was very good at publicity. He was drumming up hundreds of volunteers to help in the project. He had to drum up budgets to help in the project, and he was very good at public relations. His book went through numerous editions. The first edition, again, shows you how contemporary this type of study was. The Hebrew edition was called Mitzadah Bayamim Ahem Basman Hazeh, which is playing, you know, on text from Chanukah, and it's telling people that Masada is something which, yes, it's ancient history, but it has everything to do with us today. And his book on Masada went through editions in numerous languages. Everybody was doing Masada. They were making trips to Masada. They were swearing in soldiers to Masada. They were using Masada as an image for Israel's struggle against its enemies. The same type of thing like Meir Kahane was doing with Never Again was being done in Israel with the use of Masada. Here, just to give you an idea of this, in 1995, a professor here at Hebrew University actually wrote a book called The Masada Myth on Collective Memory and Myth-Making in Israel, namely the role of Masada in impacting upon collective memory and myth-making in the state of Israel today. On that background, if everybody's doing Masada, it's not so surprising that people are going to be studying ancient Jewish rebels in a scholarly way as well. Well, here you have an example of what's interesting Israelis in these years. The Historical Society of Israel put out a series of readers, anthologies of studies on this or that topic. And between 1973 and 83, during that decade, four of them had to do with antiquity. One of them was Jews and Judaism in the eyes of the Hellenistic world. But the other three were all about ancient Jewish rebels. The Jewish revolts in the days of Trajan, the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, or the Great Jewish Revolt, one after the other. This is what the market wanted. These are all books which are meant to serve the needs of introductory courses in universities or in colleges, and this is where the interest was. I can tell you as a teacher that in those years, I was teaching in the 70s and the 80s already, you probably had a whole lot more people interested in writing studies of ancient Jewish rebellions than you do today. If for no other reason that between, by the 1980s, between the Yom Kippur War, which was not such a promising war for Israelis, at the beginning it looked like it was going to be a catastrophe, and then the Lebanese War, which basically, if it wasn't a catastrophe, it certainly wasn't a success, between them, wars lost their luster. It wasn't like the Six-Day War where everything worked and everything was glorious, and you could put it easily alongside of victories and say, you see, the those who are willing to devote themselves to victory will achieve victory. Both of those wars undermined that. And the historians came along as well and gave their part. B'Tzalel Bar Kokhba, who was a major historian of Jewish history in the Second Temple period at the University of Tel Aviv, wrote a book in Hebrew in 1980-81 and came out again in English. Cambridge University Press, very serious work on Judah Maccabeus, the Jewish struggle against the Seleucids. So it's a book about the Jewish rebellion against the Seleucids in the second century BCE. And a major claim of the book is that the Jews did not win that war. The major claim of the book is the Jews simply held on longer than the Seleucids did, and the Seleucids got tired of fighting and they gave up. So they didn't lose, the Jews didn't lose that war, but something of the heroism of the few who can defeat the many and did so because they were heroic, some of that gets washed away by a monograph like this. And Bar Kokhba wrote a very instructive article in 1985 where he talks about the way his thesis was received in the state of Israel. And he tells there the story that he already started writing things like this in the 1960s and the early 1970s, and nobody wanted to hear it. But after the 1973 war, the army started ordering thousands of copies of what he wrote to distribute to soldiers, because the point of what he wrote was you can't take victory for granted, whereas too many people thought you could take victory for granted. Well, here's a book that I mentioned last week. Yoshafat Harkavi published a book in 1982 in Hebrew and later in 1983 in English, The Bar Kokhba Syndrome, Risk and Realism in International Relations. It's a book in which he complains about the tendency of Israeli education and Israeli politicians to make heroes out of ancient Jewish rebels who in fact lost and brought catastrophe upon the Jews, whereas had they accepted foreign rule, that would not have happened. So this is basically accepting the type of views I was imputing to Shalit last week, coming around in a big way in Israel. And people were writing for and against. Not everybody agreed with this, of course, but it has a lot to do with a loss of interest in ancient rebellions among the Jews and among the Israelis in the wake of the Yom Kippur War and the Lebanese War, as opposed to the preceding period when you thought about Jewish wars, you're either thinking about 1948, which was taken to be a war which not only was necessary, but also was won, and also the 1967 war, so you could understand that. However, it's also the case that most of the people in the world who study ancient Jewish history, certainly most of the people who study Jewish history in the first century CE, or AD as they call it, are not Jews, they're Christians. The first century is a very, very important century of Jewish history for Christians. This always has been, and it makes sense, and that's why it's called the first century, because that's where it all began for Christians. and Christians who are interested in knowing where Jesus came from, where Paul came from, where the church came from, where Christianity came from. They're all very interested in knowing what was going on in Jewish history in the first century. And probably it's the case that even today, for every book written by a Jew on the first century of Jewish history, you're going to have two or three or four written by Christians. And for every student in the world who's studying the first century of Jewish history, for every Jew, you probably have three or four or five Christians. So giving explanations about the rise and fall of Jewish interest or of Israeli interest in the Zealots is not going to be the whole story at all. We have to go further. To illustrate what I'm saying about interest, I'll simply tell you that the major book on Jewish history of the first century for the last 150 years is a book which was first written in 1873 by a German professor of theology by the name of Emil Schürer, who wrote a book which he then entitled the Lehrbuch der Neutestamentlichen Zeitgeschichte, namely a textbook for the history of the New Testament period. That's what he called the period, which is legitimate from his point of view. The New Testament period is what we're talking about. He published it first in 1873. After a while, he changed the title to Geschichte des Jüdischen Volkes, History of the Jewish People, Im Zeitalter Jesu Christi, in the age of Jesus Christ. And he defines the age of Jesus Christ as 175 BCE, namely just before the Hasmonean Revolt, until 135 CE, the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And he calls all of that the age of Jesus Christ because that's the age in which Jesus Christ was born, what preceded him, and the age of Jewish history, which is immediately after him. And it went through one edition and another edition, eventually came out in three or four editions, this volume this way, that volume that way, three volumes, came out until 1909. And when a team of scholars in England in the 1970s wanted to put out a new standard work on Jewish history of the period, I think wisely what they did is they took Schürer's German work, they translated it, and they updated it. So the history of the Jewish people in the age of Jesus Christ from 175 BC to 135, that's three volumes, and is today still the standard work. There are many, many others. And now I'll point out to you that it includes in volume two a 9-page appendix entitled The Fourth Philosophy, Sicarii and Zealots. Okay? So here we are, another one of these things. In 1979, the book finally came out. All about Sicarii and Zealots in the same period of which we're talking. Sicarii is a Latin term which means people who carry daggers. A sica, S-I-C-A, is a dagger. And the Romans, when they wanted to talk about terrorists, both in their historical works and in their legal texts, they talked about them as being sicarii. You have this also in the Talmud. Talk sometimes about sicariim and or sicaricon. These are Jewish rebels against Rome. Now, if it's the case that the study of ancient Jewish history of our period is mostly a Christian pursuit, then they're not going to be so enthusiastic about Masada or the Six-Day War or other things like that that I mentioned. And moreover, when they're looking at the sources for the first century, the main source are the writings of Josephus and the New Testament, and they give Christian scholars very little reason to take an interest in ancient Jewish rebels. Josephus mentions a few times sects, types of ancient Jews, and he says time and again there were three types of ancient Jews. There were Pharisees, there were Sadducees, and there were Essenes. Now, I think I talked to you last week already about Josephus liking things that are neatly balanced between one and the other and the one in the middle, like Three Little Bears and things like that. So he likes talking about three things, and he does time and again. He doesn't mention being a rebel as an option. Israelis were active in doing that, but most of these Christians, all of these Christian scholars, are not Israelis. True, Josephus once does mention a fourth philosophy. Once he uses that expression, but he condemns them as being foreign, as being innovative. Innovative means departing from tradition. That's bad. Being heretical. And anyway, they're involved in revolt against Rome, and that's a political project to rebel against Rome. And why should that interest Christians who are interested in the history of a religion? So even when he does mention them, the way he mentions them, it's people who should not be interesting them very much. And I'll say again, to judge by the Ecole Biblique catalog, to judge by whatever else I have on my shelf here, in fact, they didn't interest Christians very much. Books, a dime a dozen, are out there on Jewish sects in the Second Temple period, and they all tell you about Pharisees and Sadducees and Essenes, and many of them say nothing about Jewish rebels. So there was not much reason for students of ancient Jewish theology, or for those interested particularly in Jesus, who after all was a religious figure, why should they be interested in such rebels? And Shira has no chapter on rebels. Or perhaps I should say, Shira had no chapter on rebels. Because as I pointed out here, in the 1970s, when the British scholars put out a new edition of Shira, they wanted to write about the rebels, so they had to make an appendix. Because there's nothing like that in the original Shira. And believe me, the original Shira is a very, very thorough book. And nevertheless, it did not occur to him to have a chapter on ancient Jewish rebels. He mentions them now and then when he tells the story of what happened, but he does not make them into a theme for study in their own right. In the 70s, they did. So what happened in the 1960s to generate all of this interest? Well, now I'm going to switch gears and talk about modern history. I'm going to point to two dilemmas which exercised Christians of good conscience after the Holocaust. Christians of good conscience after the Holocaust had to deal with lots of things, obviously. I wanted to focus on two dilemmas. There's a lot of breastfeeding among Christians of good conscience. How could Christians not have opposed the Nazi state? As Christians, how could churches, as churches, institutionally, not have opposed the Nazi state and even collaborated with it? It's a major problem. People recognized how evil the Nazi state was during the war. Certainly after the war, they could see its crimes. And they're asking, how could we have done this? Aren't Christians supposed to be good people? And in their considerations, they immediately came up, and this is serious. It's not just something formal. We're talking about religious Christians came frontally up against a verse which has a huge history in the history of modern Christianity. And they came up against it in the 1950s. Paul, that means sacred scripture for Christians, includes the mandate, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Paul's epistle to the Romans, yes, right there in the middle of the New Testament, chapter 13, verse 1, as clear as can be, or so it seems. So Christians have to deal with this. If it's obvious to them as people that the next time something like this happens, God forbid, we really should oppose the wicked state, well, what are they going to do about this verse in sacred scriptures which says if there is a state and it has authority, it must be that God underwrites that authority? And they have another dilemma as well, because in looking back at Nazism, it became very clear to everybody very quickly that even though they were able to claim that the Nazi regime was not a Christian regime, Christian teaching of anti-Semitism over the generations had contributed to the willingness of Germans and others to be criminally anti-Semitic, be murderously anti-Semitic in the Holocaust. Christian teaching about just how despicable the Jews were contributed to the Nazi success in killing Jews. And there's a lot of concern about that. What are we supposed to do about that? And one major focus that produces hostility among Christians in the Christian sacred scriptures against Jews is the notion that the Jews were responsible for the death of Christ. That Pontius Pilate didn't find any guilt in Jesus, that he washed his hands of guilt, that he tried everything he could to get out of convicting Jesus of doing anything, but the Jews insisted on crucify him, and Pontius Pilate finally gave in to them. Well, how can then one not hate Jews if they were so wicked as to demand the unjust murder of Christ? Well, what you could start thinking is, well, maybe in fact the Jews were not responsible for the death of Christ. And you could start thinking about how to explain away why it says in the Gospels that they were. And a lot of that's going on. I'll give an example in a moment. But before you get to that, you say, well, who was then responsible for the death of Christ if it wasn't Jews? Well, if Pontius Pilate gave the order, the easiest route is to say he must have wanted to give the order, and the New Testament picture of the Jews demanding it is that which is skewed. We should probably assume that, in fact, Pontius Pilate wanted to kill Jesus. But why should he do that? Why should Pontius Pilate want to kill Jesus? Well, there can't be any good reason for Pontius Pilate to kill Jesus if Jesus was the kind of guy that the normal old Christian stereotype said he was. Namely, he was peace-loving, and he was teaching people to turn the other cheek. He was teaching people they should accept the rule of Rome and walk the extra mile and give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, namely pay taxes. So something has to give. Yes? Something has to give here. The first question about Paul's statement in Romans chapter 13 gave rise to a lot of soul searching, and it gave rise to a lot of exegetical creativity. Here, the main book to point to is a book you can read in English, but it came out in a million languages, by Oskar Kuhlmann, who was a professor of theology in Basel, Switzerland, and also in Strasbourg in France, a major figure in New Testament scholarship. Most of what he did was very philological and very technically theological, but he came out in a book in 1956 on the state in the New Testament, addressing head-on the question of, is it really the case that the New Testament requires us to accept the authority of any state and to abstain from opposing a state which is wicked? And he does what he does with the issue. Within a couple of years, 1959, Kesemann, who's a very major figure in New Testament studies, writes a long article, look at this, 60-page article on Römer 13, 1 bis 7, Romans chapter 13, 1 to 7, in our generation. It's a survey of what everybody is doing with these verses. He's studying what in our post-war German generation, what are people doing in their struggles with this opening section of Romans chapter 13. And he publishes it in a journal for theology and church, which is a journal on the border between academics and popular religion. and the article drew an awful lot of attention. Another 20 years later, we have Pohler writing his dissertation, Die Christen der Stadt nach Roman 13, Christians and the State, according to Romans 13, 1-7, in recent German-speaking interpretation of Scripture. A whole book just on what's going on in German-speaking interpretation of sacred Scripture, because everybody is trying to find a way to get around Paul. These are Christians of good conscience who nevertheless accept the authority of their sacred Scriptures, and they're trying to do something with this verse to find an opening. So maybe it has to do with the word subject. What do you mean by subject? Maybe a subject is somebody who does what's good for the government, like showing it, like telling it it's wrong. Or what do you mean by governing? You call what they're doing governing? Maybe they're not really governing, so we don't have to accept them. Or maybe authority is something which cannot be taken for granted, but can be qualified. Yes? So they can find their ways, and any of us who are familiar with the way Jews can handle sacred Scripture, we know that when you have a will to get around the biblical verse, you can. But there's another way of getting around Paul. And this is the one which is more important for us. The other way of getting around Paul is saying, well, whatever we say about Paul, Paul is a secondary figure in ancient Christianity. He is the main secondary figure, but the primary figure of ancient Christianity is Jesus. And if it were the case that Jesus was a rebel against Rome, then it would be, by definition, legitimate for a Christian to be a rebel against a wicked empire. So I'm going to not get in, as you see, I'm not going to get any details what people tried to do with Romans 13. I'm going to talk about the other way of dealing with Paul, and that's by doing an end run around Paul and saying, well, let's see what Jesus was like. Now here you see a card catalog entry from the Harvard University Library. It gives you an idea of what's going on in the world of German scholarship about ancient Judaism. This is the listing for a German series. You know, books frequently come out in series. That's the way the publisher can make sure that people are going to buy all of the books. You call this volume one, volume two. Here you have a series of books which appeared in Leiden, published by Brill. It's a publisher in Leiden, a scholarly publisher, beginning in 1968. But this series actually begins with volume 6 and volume 7. That's kind of strange. Most series begin with volume 1. The name of the series is Arbeiten zur Geschichte späteren Judentums des Urchristentums, Studies in the History of Later Judaism and Early Christianity. Why does it begin with volume 6 and 7? Because it's continuing a series which was called Studies in the History of Spätjudentums und Urchristentum. It's continuing a series which was called Studies in the History of Late Judaism and Early Christianity. And beginning in 1968, they decided to change the name from Late Judaism to Later Judaism. Well, let me explain that. Spätjudentum, this term you have here, is the classic term used by Christian scholarship of Judaism in antiquity. And why should it be called late Judaism? Because when they use that term, they mean Judaism in its late legitimate stage, in its last legitimate stage before it was replaced by Christianity. It's a term which implies that since the appearance of Christianity, Judaism really is out of date. It shouldn't be there because its last legitimate stage was in the first century CE when it came to fruition, as they would say, in the fullness of time with the appearance of Jesus and the beginning of a new covenant instead of the old covenant. Now, that's a view of Judaism which fosters anti-Semitism, because it's telling people that people who go on being Jews are doing something which is running counter to God's plan for the Jews. And that's not very nice. And here you see that although the series began in 1961, as we'll see in a minute, with a title, with this title, which was the traditional Christian title, within 7 years, they were already saying, well, that's not very nice. Let's say not late Judaism, later Judaism. It's later than the Old Testament period, but we're not claiming it's the last period of Jews' history. They did that for two volumes, and beginning in 1968, they went the whole way, and they changed it to Arbeit und Zukunft des antiken Judentums. They said, the series is now going to be works on the history of ancient Judaism and early Christianity. Now, when you talk about ancient Judaism, you are definitely making way for legitimate Jewish history subsequent to the first century. So here you see a little bit of German study of ancient Judaism moving away from anti-Semitism bit by bit. It took them some years to move away from the traditional terminology, but they did it, and the series still exists until today. Lately, they're using an English title, Ancient Judaism and Early Christianity, one that doesn't deny the continued legitimacy of Judaism. The guy who forced them to change the name of the title, as he tells in his memoirs, was Martin Hengel, who I mentioned before, who wrote his dissertation on Die Zeloten, the Zealots, and the book appeared in that series with its first name, Studies in the History of Late Judaism and Early Christianity, and appeared in 1961. It was originally his doctoral dissertation and appeared a couple of years later in print. And what is Hengel's book about? Hengel was a theologian. He's writing a book about the Zealots. If before I told you that Christians have no particular reason to be interested in Zealots because they were into politics and Christians are interested in the history of a religious movement, the main point of Hengel's book is that the Zealots were religious people. The Zealots were religious. Now, he bases his argument to a very large extent on the very term zeal, kana'ut, which he traces to Pinchas and to Eliyahu. You know, we had a statement in Bamidbar, in the Book of Numbers, the story about Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron, kineh kinati, and you have Eliyahu saying the same thing about himself, I've been zealous, and obviously Pinchas was a religious person, he was the father of all the high priests, and Eliyahu was a prophet. The rabbis talk about kanaim, and they give them approval in some contexts. So it must be that they were religious. And what Hengel's book is devoted to doing is arguing against Josephus, because Josephus was so concerned to denigrate the Zealots, to tell the Romans that the Zealots are doing something which is totally un-Jewish, that Josephus portrayed them as being heretical, portrayed them as being innovators. And Hengel says, no, no, they were doing what the Jewish tradition and scripture indicated they should be doing. And Hengel was also arguing against Joseph Klausner, who I mentioned before, an Israeli nationalist historian who was very busy portraying the Zealots positively, as opposed to Josephus, who portrayed them negatively, but positively for Klausner meant portraying them as nationalists. They were like modern non-religious Zionists who were out there trying to build a Jewish state in the first century. And Hengel argues that interpreting the first century in line with modern secular Zionism is anachronistic. And if you want to know what's motivating Hengel, well, it's precisely what I was talking about before. Because if it's the case that the Zealots were a rebellious movement, that means that, if it's the case that the Zealots were a religious movement, the Zealots who were rebels against Rome were religious people, that means a religious Jew could have been a zealot. Take Jesus, for example. He could have been a rebel against Rome. And if he was a rebel against Rome, that would explain, by the way, why Pontius Pilate would have to kill him and would get the Jews off the hook. And this would be a way then of contributing to the reduction of Christian anti-Semitism by saying that, as a matter of fact, the Jews were not responsible for the death of Christ. And that would entail, of course, explaining, so why do the Gospels say they were? And that can be done very easily by historians. I promised this to you before. Namely, all you have to do is realize that Christianity was a religious movement in the Roman Empire. And if some Christian missionary, let's say, is standing on a box in some public square in Rome and preaching Christianity and preaching just how wonderful a guy Jesus was, and somebody says, oh, I'd like to meet him, and the missionary says, well, he's dead. And he says, oh, did he die of a disease? And he has to say, no, actually a Roman governor killed him. Any good upstanding Roman citizen should infer from that that he must have been a criminal, and we don't want to have anything to do with the religion of followers of a criminal. So the Christian preaching in the Roman Empire required them to claim that although the Roman Empire, through its agent, a Roman governor, killed Jesus, that was really a mistake. The governor didn't want to do it. The Jews pushed him into doing it. That's what Hengel does, like lots of other people do. You can say that Gospels had their reasons for saying what they said, but the truth was Pontius Pilate really had a very good reason to kill Jesus because he was a rebel. That would get the Jews off the hook, and that would also, like I said before, allow us to do an end run around Paul, because whatever you say about Paul in Romans 13, if Jesus could oppose Rome, then we could have opposed the Nazis, and if it ever happens again, we should oppose whoever is going to behave like the Nazis. And you have a boom of literature. Hengel's book came out in 61. It was doctored already in 59. A boom of literature. At the same time, literature on the Zealots and rebels is booming in Israel because of the Masada excavations and the State of Israel and the other things I mentioned and the Six-Day War. What's going on around the world is people are writing books and books about the trial of Jesus, the death of Jesus, Jesus the Zealot. Books on the trial of Jesus are all devoted to showing that, as a matter of fact, Pontius Pilate did what he wanted to do and probably had good Roman reason to do what he did. Brandon Jesus the Zealot comes right out in so many words and gives the thesis, and he has a chapter in the book called The Origin of the Pacific Christ. I mean, where did the notion come from that Jesus was such a peace-loving person? And he has to explain that away as a product of the needs of early Christianity in the Roman world, but it really wasn't like that. He complemented that with a book on the trial of Jesus. These are all front-running scholars. Chaim Cohn, judge in the Israeli Supreme Court, wrote on the trial and death. Here we have one in Dutch. The execution of Jesus. By 1971, somebody's already writing a study on the history of the study of the trial of Jesus. Yes, this is like I showed you before, a study of the history of the study of Romans 13 in German-speaking scriptural interpretation. Catchpole's writing in 1971. Maccoby's writing a book on revolution in Judea, Jesus and the Jewish resistance. Everybody's doing it. And it's coming out of the needs of Christians to deal with these dilemmas which people of good conscience encounter, Christians of good conscience encountered in the wake of the Holocaust. That explains the boom. But what happened is things started getting out of hand for two main reasons. The first one is what I would call cold feet. Kuhlmann, who started the thing off in the 50s, and Hengel, who started the thing off late in the 50s with his doctorate, started writing books saying, well, we didn't really want to go that far and portray Jesus as a revolutionary. They started backing away from it. You have to take things in a more nuanced way. Yes, he did oppose Rome, but he wasn't out there rebelling. Maybe some of his followers went further than he would have gone and further than we should go. They started backing away from this. And these books came out in various languages, and they're sort of like putting cold water on everything which was going on just a few years before. And by 76, Maccoby, the same guy who was writing an article on revolution, Jesus and Jewish, he's looking around saying, wait a minute, what happened? The air went out of the balloon. Is the political Jesus dead? And he's arguing about it. He's describing why people are losing interest in this. But there was something about this notion that we could remake Christianity within a few years into something which it never had been, something which scared people away, maybe properly, but nevertheless, they backed away from it. And there's another more scholarly reason as well. Until now, I've been talking about zealots. And in fact, once upon a time, scholars called all ancient Jewish rebels zealots. This is an article by Morton Smith in 1970. Morton Smith was a professor in Columbia. It's long been the common opinion that the zealots were the party founded by Judas the Galilean, so Gretz and Yost, for instance, writing in the middle of the past century. Derenborg, it's true, observed the term zealots was not applied to the opponents of Rome before the revolt, 66. But when he came to the events of the rebellion, revolt, he made a descendant of Judas Menachem, the leader of zealots, and so apparently assumed the connection. Scherer's adherents canonized the common opinion and also the common description of Sicarii as a more fanatical fraction of the party. So everybody thinks that all the rebels are zealots. And here, for example, you have Scherer, who I told you before, the main textbook for 150 years of Jewish history and antiquity. When he first mentions Judas the Galilean, Judas of Gamla, called Judas the Galilean, he forms a party of rebels, and he says, as they call themselves, activists or zealots. There's a footnote here about zelotai, zealots, and what they're called here and what they're called there, and he makes no effort at all to distinguish among rebels and say, well, some of them were zealots and some of them were not. And you remember, Hengel's case was that zealots, by the very name, must have been religious people. Well, along comes a wave of scholarship which argues, beginning in the mid-60s, but especially as time goes on in the early 70s, one after the other, boom, 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 articles started coming out. Wait a minute. Josephus doesn't call all the ancient rebels zealots. He only uses the term the first time in 66 CE to refer to some of the rebels. But Judas the Galilean and all these people who were around for decades, including the decades in which Jesus lived and died, were not called zealots. They're called sicarii, which I told you means dagger bearers, what the Romans use when they want to talk about terrorists. They have other names, but all of this wonderful case that Hengel made about rebels being religious people turns out to apply to people who lived, as far as we can see, or appeared on the historical stage, as far as we can see, decades after Jesus was dead already. And people are writing this one time after another, and they're pointing, for example, to a prominent passage in Josephus's War, which now becomes functional. It's been there for all these years. People didn't pay much attention. Josephus in War, the last book of his book about the Jewish War, looking back, says there were all sorts of troublemakers. There were the Sicarii. There was John of Gishchara. There was Simon Bar Gior. There were the Idumeans. There were the Zealots. But these are all different groups. Well, if the Zealots didn't exist until 66, then Jesus wasn't a Zealot. And if before I said people were backing away from this because they had cold feet about what this does to Christianity when you portray the founder of Christianity as being an anti-Roman rebel, now you see the philologists, the historians, coming in and saying, well, we don't have to claim that. And here, for example, we have an article from 1971. We can thus see that the consensus in favor of the currency of the term zealot during the ministry of Jesus is founded on only one on one and only one ambiguous item of evidence. Luke chapter 6 is the only thing you can find. Should zealotes, zealot, there be translated with a capital Z or a lowercase z? And he says, against the common translation, he thinks it should be a lowercase one. There's no evidence there was a party designation until 66 CE. and you might write here QED, we got out of that. Yes. A decade after it began, 15 years after it began, Christians are allowed to back away from the notion that Jesus was a rebel. At this point, the historians who want to can go on making a general claim about, well, there probably was some similarity between these movements, but they didn't have to make any specific claim about the zealots existing in the days of Jesus. And they start writing articles on the question of the unity and diversity. Were they all the same or not? What do they have in common? Yes. Or Smith might write a general article called The Troublemakers. If you have very little resolution, you could look at everybody and say, yeah, they're all rebels, but there's nothing that requires you to impose a religious program upon any of them apart from the zealots. And the scholarship then could go back to a very low flame. So in sum, what I'm telling you in this case, a major flourishing of scholarship on an ancient Jewish movement, which hitherto had been of little interest to Christians, was generated. The flourishing was generated in great measure by Christian and especially German Christian self-examination concerning the role of Christianity in fostering the Holocaust. Once such self-examination issued in more direct results, such as Vatican II, and Nostra Aetate, which is a declaration in the wake of Vatican II that the Jews of today are not responsible for the death of Christ, scholarship and believing Christians could back away from the more radical and more specific claims concerning Jesus. And with that, Christian interest waned because, again, they had no interest to be reason to be interested. And that was around the same time that the Yom Kippur War and then the Lebanese War put a damper on Israeli enthusiasm about the same thing. But in the meantime, scholarship progressed in its understanding of the diversity of ancient Jewish rebels, as also of Josephus's portrayal of them. So there was some profit for scholarship in this episode, because all of this attention made us realize that Josephus has a very diversified view of something which hitherto had been thought to be very unified. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, do you want to take a couple of the questions in a few questions in the chat box? You want to take a look? We'll give you a minute.
I'm going to the beginning, I think. Where's the beginning?
Yeah. The first question, I guess, or you can take a look.
Oh, I see. The sun is shining. Is there a, I'm planning on sending out the PowerPoint to the rabbi after this, also last week's PowerPoint.
Yeah. I guess also, if I may, I don't know if they're asking Janine, if, in general, if there's, you know, something you'd recommend is reading material, a book or something to read on some of these things. I mean, you've posted many of the books, like, you know, 85 books, but
I quoted books, and at the beginning of each of the slides, I give a reference to what I've written on the subject. If somebody wants more, I think it's best. Some of you have been corresponding with me on the side anyways. If anybody wants to, I can probably give you some more suggestions. Will the slides be posted? Yes, they will. What Shul responding to Paul when he said, pray for Shlomo Malchut? I don't know what that question is asking. But when you haven't Pirkei Avot, Havemi Pelel Shlomo Shlomo Malchut, somebody saying you should pray for the peace because otherwise it's going to be chaos. It's probably a similar attitude like Paul's. So somebody's complaining about the way the Church of England reacted to ISIS terrorism. I have nothing to say about that. Okay. There are references to Pontius Pilate, not in Roman literature. He's mentioned once by Tacitus, but just in passing. He's mentioned at some great length in Josephus and in Philo. And Josephus portrays him as basically as a responsible Roman governor who is being strict, but he's doing his job and he's willing to respect the Jews and their religious sensitivities. Philo portrays him as being a very nasty and corrupt governor. And we could talk about that too if we want. Were there Polish theologians who wrote about this? I don't know. Is the case? I don't know. yes, liberation theology, somebody refers to, is one of the things that people like Kuhlmann and Hengel were afraid of. This notion of a rebellious Jesus was, people were taking it and running with it, especially in South America. And that was creating a lot of fear in the church that we've gone too far with this. Were most of the writers religious Christians? Yes. Who else cares about doing this type of thing? Both about the Jewish history of our period and interpretation of sacred scriptures. And liberation theology, again, it's the same thing. What is the word for zealots in the Jewish sources? So we have Kanaim, and for example, the Mishnah talks about Kanaim Pogimbo. What are the things that Kanaim do? And that's literally zealots. Being old enough to remember the 1970s, I'm surprised that the rise and vilification of Menachem Begin didn't revive interest in Jewish zealotry. It probably did. I'm willing to bet that just like somebody earlier referred to the Church of England's pointing to ancient zealots in regard to ISIS, I'm willing to bet that the British Mandate government was using similar analogies in decrying Jewish terrorism in the 30s and 40s. Can you speak to the role of the Second Vatican Council and John's attitude toward it? No, definitely. These are, I pointed to them as being much more successful in changing Christian attitudes towards Jews, or at least trying to. It came out both with the papal pronunciation about the Jews' responsibility, it came out with the a new translation of scripture, the Einheitsübersetzung, the main new German translation of the sacred scriptures, came out after Vatican II, in the wake of Vatican II, among other things, with instructions about how to deal with the Jews. And we'll see some of that next week in my last lecture of the series. The sign and research, exactly. The sign over the crucifixion that Jesus of Nazareth was the King of the Jews indicates that that's the charge on which he was executed. Is that a joke or was it serious? Is something people have written endlessly about. Part of the claim that in fact he was a rebel and Pontius Pilate meant to kill him for that reason is that the sign like that was taken seriously. Other people would have preferred to say it was a bad joke. He was being ironic and didn't really mean it. Okay, I just ran through those questions in the chat box, but I say if anybody wants to correspond with me,